From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from Benicia.
Sunset District.
I live in Lakeside.
The Western Addition.
Diamond Heights.
Emeryville, California.
Westwood Park.
Coming up, we'll meet a local Oakland student who feels the real impact of the national immigration debate.
They were asking me for my Social Security number, and I was like, well, I don't have one.
Then we'll look at the economy of San Francisco's Mission District with a member of its vibrant past.
When we opened the doors in 1989, I was just pleasantly surprised at the number of artists that were coming in to shop here.
And with a member of its highly competitive future.
We knew that we wouldn't be able to afford the total space that we needed in this corridor. But we knew for the survival of our business and the foot traffic that's available in this neighborhood that we should be here.
Getting some perspective today on Cross Currents. When you're undocumented in this country, it usually means you carry around a very big secret. So even when the president says he's getting serious about immigration reform,
I'm here today because the time has come for common sense, comprehensive immigration reform. The time is now.
As he did yesterday in Nevada, it's still hard for undocumented people to believe they might find a legal place in society. Last June, the Obama administration issued an executive order called DACA, or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals.
It's a way for undocumented youth to really come out of the shadows, to ideally be able to put their education, their experience to use in a productive setting.
Marilia Zellner helps students apply for DACA in California, which basically gives young people a chance to get a temporary work permit. California has the largest number of DACA applicants so far, but initially the turnout was low. The strict guidelines and two-year limit of the work permit make applying for DACA a risky venture for many undocumented young people. From Mills College in Oakland, Esther Honig brings us the story of one young woman, a fellow student and friend, who saw DACA as an opportunity worthy of the risk. And to protect the identity of her family, we're using her nickname, Nay Medina.
You might not have caught it, but when President Obama gave his second inaugural address, he directed 16 seconds of it right at Nay Medina.
Our journey is not complete until we find a better way to welcome the striving, hopeful immigrants who still see America as a land of opportunity, until bright young students and engineers are enlisted in our workforce rather than expelled from our country.
This fridge is usually empty because I'm a broke college student.
That's Nay Medina. She is giving me a tour of her dorm room on the Mills College campus.
Right now, this is my desk. I can't focus here, so when I really want to focus, I sit on this rug, and I just spread all my papers all over the place, and I study. It's a beautiful thing.
Nay is a senior and is graduating early with a degree in politics and economics. She's entering the Mills MBA program in the spring, but her big dream is to go to law school.
I definitely see myself going into the courtroom like a hardcore, you know, attorney, suited up with my suitcase, just ready.
The only thing that could hold Nay back is that she doesn't have a Social Security number. That's because she's undocumented.
I was born in Mexicali, Baja California, right across the border. And my parents never really wanted to come to the U.S. They didn't really, you know, want to live here. It kind of just happened out of necessity.
Nay's father came to California first and brought the rest of the family when Nay was six. She entered the U.S. on a visitor's visa and every few months would go back to Mexico to have it renewed. This is technically illegal. Before she turned 18, Nay decided to stop using the visa for fear that it might make her ineligible for citizenship.
I feel like for a 17, 18-year-old, that's a big decision to make.
So without her visa, Nay began living in the U.S. undocumented. Her family was in the same situation. In the beginning, it worked out fine.
I became a senior, and the college application rounds started to come up. And, you know, they were asking me for my Social Security number. And I was like, well, I don't have one.
But she did have plenty of other things to list on her application.
I played volleyball, basketball, and softball all 4 years. And I was ASB president. I was president of my class. I founded a Spanish club in my high school.
All of this helped her get accepted to her top schools.
UCLA, UC Davis, UCSB. I had all these amazing schools I had a dream school I wanted to go to, but because I didn't qualify for financial aid, it was just not an option for me.
In California, undocumented students do qualify for in-state tuition, but that was still beyond what Nay could afford. Her status made her ineligible for loans from the federal government, and even private banks refuse anyone without a Social Security number. So she's happy she found Mills College, which offered her scholarships and a part-time job. With support from her family, she's managed to afford the cost of tuition.
I've been so blessed with my family, and my father in particular. He's such a fighter.
Nay's father has been a foreman on an orchard since he came to California, supporting his wife and four children. Whenever Nay was in doubt, she would turn to him.
He would always be like, "You keep going. You don't let anyone stop you. Like, you're gonna go places. You know what I mean? Like, your status is not gonna stop you from that."
And it hasn't. But she still has big obstacles ahead. It's not clear whether Nay can legally practice as a lawyer. And without some form of authorized residence in the U.S., she can't work anywhere. That's where DACA comes in. Known formally as the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, if she's approved, DACA gives Nay the ability to at least work here legally, but just for 2 years.
Being told that they have something that's temporary, 2 years, and then may be taken away at any time is certainly a far cry from what they, you know, would want and deserve.
Marilia Zellner works with Educators for Fair Consideration, an organization that's been helping students apply for DACA. There is very strict criteria to apply. Like, you must have arrived in the U.S. before age 16, be younger than 31, and have a clean criminal record. But even if you're approved, DACA doesn't grant applicants legal status or a path to citizenship. It just amounts to a temporary work permit. Zellner says this is not the expansive immigration reform she had hoped for. Here's President Obama speaking on the issue during his 2012 State of the Union address.
The opponents of action are out of excuses. We should be working on comprehensive immigration reform right now.
It's been something that has been promised for a long time by Obama's administration. And so, arguably it doesn't quite live up to that, to what was promised. But, some people are also saying, well, you know, better something than nothing, better late than never.
There are an estimated 11 million people living in the U.S. undocumented, and about 2 million will qualify for DACA. For Nay Medina, it's a big opportunity.
For me, of course, DACA was such a blessing because I qualify for it. You know, I came in here at the age of 6. I've been living here for about 15 years. No criminal background. And I have all the documents to prove all of this.
Initially, registration numbers for DACA were surprisingly low. For those in the undocumented community, there's an obvious fear associated with handing personal information to U.S. immigration officials.
And nobody knows what's going to happen after these 2 years. They're saying that after the 2 years are up, you could renew it and you would have to pay the $465 fee again. But because it's so new again, like, it's still, nobody knows. It's still being developed, but it is a risk.
It's a risk that's paid off for Nay. She's recently received her work permit through DACA, and it's likely more undocumented students will apply now that President Obama's reelection has guaranteed the future of the program. In Oakland, I'm Esther Honig for Cross Currents.
Esther Honig is a student reporter with Mills College in Oakland. If you're an undocumented immigrant and want to tell us how you feel about immigration reform and the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, you can leave us a message at 415-264-7106. That number again to leave us a message is 415-264-7106. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. Immigrant communities and neighborhoods seem to be focal points for change in a city. A great example is San Francisco's Mission District. It might be known today as a Latino neighborhood, but before the 1940s, it was predominantly Irish. And if you walk down Valencia or 24th Street today, you'll see the neighborhood is clearly going through a big transition again. upscale restaurants and coffee shops now dominate the businesses in this area, which is a sign of increased home prices and rents that have pushed many older businesses out. Places like Adobe Books on 16th and Valencia. After 24 years, the unconventional bookshop, known for its backroom art gallery and communal atmosphere, is under threat of eviction. The eviction date is indefinite, and shop owner Andrew McKinley says there's still hope for the store as he works to transform it into a collective run by volunteers. In this piece from our archives, KALW's Holly J. McDeed speaks to McKinley about his store and about how he's seen the community around him change.
Why, Simon, how are you? It's good to see you. And Molly, too.
Hi.
Good to see
you.
I love
my parents.
Oh, very nice. The Carters.
Yeah.
Hi.
Andrew McKinley.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Yeah.
I'm
Andrew Charlie.
Good to have you in.
Thank you.
Your daughter is good. Do you remember the old days? The Mission was sleepier. Correct me if I'm wrong, but there was less activity. There was less people. It was poor. It was a little more dangerous, or considered more edgy. And yet there was a vitality in that when we opened the doors in 1989, I was just surprised and pleasantly surprised at the number of artists that were coming in to shop here. Oh, hey, Sade. Great to see you.
Which one's five?
Oh, great. Alcatraz. It's $15, but I'll make it 12 today.
You're a beautiful man.
Well, we're in a selling mood. Some of the best selling stuff is poetry. You can never get enough good poetry. On our left here, you'll find Swan, alias John Ratliff. He's our perennial habitué of the store.
John Ratliff, my real name.
Yes. Okay, we've woken him up there. Any comments for the press? Okay, no. You know, some people think we've done a lot for the art scene. And I don't know what to say, because when I sit back here now and think about it, what have we done? What happened here? It was the setting for a lot of artistic energy. Artists hung out here. They interacted. Some of them married each other, or, you know, they bounced off each other. And friendships were made, associations in the arts. Economics have forced a lot of artists away from here. They don't hang out as much. It's possible the art energy has moved to Oakland or something. There's a lot of artists living there. If you go to the First Fridays or the Art Murmur, the energy is amazing. We've never gotten that type of energy for local things here. I mean, we've had some intense parties where hundreds of pretty much younger people have showed up. But I'm impressed with what's going on in Oakland. Simon, you should pick out a book there. You need another good book.
Do you have any books on... I'll think of that.
All right, I have a whole stack of books. I should give you one. Well, I guess I'm just old-fashioned. Am I old? Am I tired? I don't know. I've been comfortable doing it this way. And I've grown up in a tradition. I spent my youth in an era with... you know, very few electronics. And books were always respected in my family. Education was cherished, worshipped. But I've not adapted that well to the modern age. I can barely type. I can't type, really. And my computer skills are almost nil. I do believe in and accept computers as the future. But I've just never... I've relied on book learning and book exposure rather than internet surfing and exploring. It's just a different world, and a world that's now becoming part of the past as it dies off. I feel safer and safer all the time, but now I'm, you know, in danger of losing the space as a storefront. It's just too expensive for used books. Somebody else could probably do very well here, selling who knows what. Tacos, even. I mean, have you been to Tacolicious? Everything's gone upscale. I'd probably have to sell a wider variety of items. New books, remainders, cards, newspapers, magazines, clothing. Liquor would be a good thing. If I had a liquor license, I'd probably be doing fine. I'm going to liquidate all the books. And I think that's the best way to behave. Until an actual savior comes, a white knight, a moneyed person, or a group that can raise the money. I mean, without money, this place will be gone. It won't kill me, because I can survive. I have a cheap apartment. I can sell books online. I'll survive. Some of the people who form the community here, who hang out here all the time, will lose something more. I don't know. Once it goes, it'll vanish into air. It'll be gone with the wind, I like to say. It'll become part of history or legend or mythology. I don't know. It'll just become part of the past.
That's Andrew McKinley, who owns Adobe Books. He spoke with KALW's Holly J. McDeed, who produced that report. And Adobe Books is still fighting to keep its doors open. They'll be launching a fundraising campaign on Indiegogo soon. You can get updates at Adobe's Facebook page. This is Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. If you walk just 2.5 blocks down from Adobe Books on Valencia, you'd find yourself at one of the street's newest additions, a patisserie, which is French for pastry shop. The San Francisco Chronicle reported last October that at least 16 new eateries opened on Valencia Street in the span of a year and a half. With so much competition and skyrocketing rents, it's a sink-or-swim atmosphere for business owners. So KALW's RTM's Kuna Hoffs went to the patisserie to find out what made the owner decide to set up shop in such a competitive market.
We have quite a few savory pastries, actually. The Gougère is probably the staff's favorite.
Pumpkin muffins, Gougère, hazelnut financière. These are a few tasty pastries I'm offered when I walk into Craftsman and Wolves on Valencia Street.
It's a patisserie for San Francisco. Like, the traditions are based, a lot of it in French pastries, but then there's also definitely an American part of it as well.
Kate Meadow-Killoran is the general manager of Craftsman and Wolves. She and chef William Warner are two of the five founders of this business, which opened in June 2012.
We have known each other and always kind of traveled around each other.
Killoran spent most of her career in the restaurants of the Ritz-Carlton hotel chain. She moved to San Francisco to manage a bakery called Telltale, along with William Warner. But due to disagreements with the owners and investors, that business closed down.
This is the first time we really had to work together, and it just worked well. And so we decided, let's continue. Stay together. little brother, never wanted.
The name of the patisserie came out of a struggle they experienced with the previous business.
My partner, William Warner, he just had this moment of that frustration of being the craftsman. You know, that's all you have, your hands and what's in your head. And you create these things and you're really just working with your hands and trying to do something perfect. And then there's these wolves who come and try to take it away from you. But then also you needed wolves, because if there's no demand for it, then what are you doing all of this for anyways?
The patisserie's location on Valencia between 18th and 19th is among the best in the city. The high restaurant density and vibrant atmosphere make it one of the most competitive parts of the Mission District. Some, like the Valencia Corridor Merchants Association, believe that there are already too many restaurants on Valencia, and it is pushing to impose a one-year moratorium on new establishments. Craftsman and Wolves is not the only French bakery in the area. It is just two blocks away from another one, named 13.
I know people talk about competition. I don't see it as competition. I think it creates a beautiful destination. I don't see Tartine as competition. I think of them almost like a parent figure. They showed us what we can do, and then we decided to do something in a different way. I think we benefit them, they benefit us. I think that's really beautiful.
But she admits that it's not easy to make it work, especially in the beginning.
As well as you plan, there's always more. So it's, I would recommend that get a million and then try to budget only for $650, and then you'll see how you go. And then, you know, another part of it is you should have cash resources for the, at least for the first 3 months. You know, don't think that you'll be able to pay for anything. Because people don't know who you are. As much as you think people know who you are, they don't know who you are.
So Kiloran and her partners put a lot of thought into the redesign of this space, which used to be a car garage.
Yeah, for Jaguar. Yeah. So it was fancy before we got here.
Yes, fancy. A word many long-time Mission residents seem to dislike, as it translates into higher prices and higher rent. According to a recent interview in the San Francisco Chronicle with local business owners, the average commercial rent is now comparable to those in the Marina and Kauholo neighborhoods.
The rent is expensive, and it's one of the reasons why we chose a smaller footprint on Valencia. And we have our commissary kitchen over in Bayview, because we knew that we wouldn't be able to afford the total space that we needed in this corridor. But we knew for the survival of our business and the foot traffic that's available in this neighborhood that we should be here.
I asked Lauren about how she may be contributing to gentrification in the neighborhood. She said businesses like hers shouldn't get the blame.
I am a small business, so I don't think that I'm doing anything wrong. I hire a very diverse crew. They're very young. I'm giving job opportunities to young people who are just coming out of college, trying to figure out who they are, what they're doing. I'm creating a safe environment for them to work in.
Her partner, William Warner, actually lives here in the Mission, which was another reason to open up on Valencia.
I wanted to be able to call people by name for them to know who I am, to really have a sense of community. And that's how we want to establish. We just didn't want to come in and take over. We wanted to be part of the community. I think we've done that.
But still, not everyone can afford to have a slice of cake for $7.
Some of our things are pricey and some of our things are not. And it's our commitment to have things of quality. It means that we're going to buy things that are quality. And in San Francisco, things are pricey. So I'm right along there with you.
So who are the target customers for places like Craftsman and Wolves? Perhaps some of them are the people who are moving into the new apartment buildings on the same block.
A lot of bartenders from around the neighborhood are coming in and grabbing a cookie and a cup of coffee before they go into work. We get the moms that come in with their new babies in the late afternoon or early or late morning, which is really nice to see. And what we notice is really it's the businesses around us who come and support us on a daily basis, and then we really get to see all the neighbors and the families on the weekends.
Out the door, and once you go out the door, turn to the right.
Despite the long working hours and other pressures that come along with owning a business, Kiloran says the struggle is worth it.
I used to wear suits and 3-inch heels and stockings every day, and now I get to wear jeans and t-shirts and clogs. My back doesn't hurt anymore, so that's fantastic.
Craftsman and Wolves has gotten high praise from critics in local food magazines and blogs, but it's yet to be proven whether in the long term it will attract stable customers. In the meantime, it doesn't hurt for Kiloran to keep up her good attitude. In the Mission, I'm Artem Skonohos for Cross Currents.
You want to tell us about changes in your neighborhood? Is there a shop that's closed down or been threatened with eviction? A cafe that's opened? What's the effect on the feel of your neighborhood? You can leave us a message at 415-264-7106, and we'll try to get your story on the air. That number again to leave us a message is 415-264-7106. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. And now it's time for your stories from San Francisco StoryCorps. The San Francisco StoryCorps booth at the Contemporary Jewish Museum is celebrating its fourth anniversary this week, and it's hosting a celebration with founder Dave Isay tomorrow night. In honor of this momentous occasion, we leave you today with one of our favorite StoryCorps interviews to ever air on Cross Currents. It's from an interview between Diane Daniels and her friend Pat Fodor about Diane's role in the team of IBM programmers behind the Apollo 11 mission back in 1969.
I was only 22 at the time, pretty fresh out of college. So I was working on the test module for the telemetry system. The telemetry, just for everyone's knowledge, is the communications between the ground control computers and the computers that are in the orbiting spacecraft. And that was really difficult to do when we first started putting stuff up in the sky. With the moon landing, all of a sudden, we have a lunar landing module, so we have the spacecraft orbiting above the moon. We've got a rover that's going down to the moon, and then, my God, we have two guys who want to get out of it. I mean, you know, I think as a programmer, I would have, might even have said, well, can't we kind of limit the functionality here? Because this is really getting complex.
This is hard.
it's really hard. And that, you know, we've just had this two-way conversation between ground control and the spacecraft. And so now we're going to have something, a third one on the moon. And then when you think of each person who got out and two different men walking on the moon, each of them were a separate communications module. So we had five modules that we had to make sure we didn't drop any bits. I mean, if we drop a bit, you know, maybe then we lose track of them. They can't get off the moon. Fast forward a year to the actual moonshot.
Buzz, this is Houston. F2, I'm at the 1/160th second for shadow photography on the sequence camera.
And I was in tears, Pat. Part of me was terrified something wasn't going to work. That all of a sudden he's going to step out of the module and something in the communications would break down. And Neil, where are you, Neil? We can't find you, Neil. And I'm going to think, oh my God, I was responsible for testing this. You know, it was me and 800 other young programmers.
But you felt that personal sense of responsibility even after your job was done.
Yeah, I'm going to step off the land now.
And when he got back in, and finally later the lunar lander got back up to the spacecraft, I was in tears.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
So anyway, fast forward another 6 or 8 months, and I'm back in Washington, D.C., and we have a little reunion of many of us who had worked on Apollo 11. Not one of the men owned up to any type of emotional feeling when Neil Armstrong walked on the moon. You know, I cried. And so the rest of them, oh, yeah, sure. Of course, we wrote it. Of course it's going to work. So, you know, you wonder, it came out beautifully. And so you have to give credit to the management structure that was all white male who made it work. You can also say as a female programmer, I was one of the few female scientist working on the system. And I think it was really the first time I really started to understand some of the cultural biases that result in so few women going into math, which was my major in school, or sciences. And so I was lonely, and it made me raise my consciousness to see how can we help other women get more engaged in engineering so they could experience the thrill of being a part of something as exciting as putting a man on the moon.
That's the surface is fine and powdery. I can pick it up loosely with my toe. It does adhere in fine layers, like powdered charcoal, to the sole and sides of my boots. I only go in a small fraction of an inch, maybe an eighth of an inch, but I can see the footprints of my boots and the treads in the fine sandy particles.
Neil, this is Houston. We're copying.
That was Diane Daniels speaking with her friend Pat Fodor at the StoryCorps booth in the Contemporary Jewish Museum in downtown San Francisco. And you can join StoryCorps founder Dave Isay for a celebration of the team's fourth anniversary in the Bay Area tomorrow night at the museum. The event starts at 6:30 p.m. For more details, you can go to klw.org. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. Today's team includes Isabel Angel, Julie Kane, Leela Day, Alyssa Kapnick, Audrey Dilling, Maya DePaula Hanica, Chris Hoff, Laura Saponara, Panina Eilberg-Schwartz, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Erica Mu, Ray Sue Sussman, and Stephen Short, who just celebrated a birthday. Happy birthday, Mr. Short, who is also Mr. Tall around here. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. And thanks to City Car Share, which provides an alternative transportation option for our reporters. You'll find them online at citycarshare.org. Also, thanks to you. KALW is listener-supported, locally independent radio because of you. Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. We'll visit a local art exhibit where survivors of Japan's tsunami remember their experience through tanka poetry.
Moriagari osoi kuru o tsunami kono yo no mono to omo ezu.
You know, we've just been flooded. I'm outside. I'm trying to find my children, you know, my parents, my baby.
That's tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents. You're listening to the Mezzacapa Phillips Duo. They'll be performing their improvised acoustic experimentations as part of the Creative Music Series at the Luggage Store Artist Space in San Francisco tomorrow starting at 8 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.
This is Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. Each week, we'll play you a sound recorded somewhere in the Bay Area. Your job? Figure out where it's from and exactly what it is, and then call us and let us know. Ready? Here we go.
Okay, thank you. Anyone need tickets?
Anybody selling? Got extra?
Can you identify what that was and where we recorded it? Call 415-264-7106 and tell us. And then let us know where we should record next. We'll reveal the answer every Thursday night on Cross Currents, so tune in. What's the sound of where you live? Call 415-264-7106.